We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television.
All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
As far as the wide world is concerned, England is anything but superior. She is just humiliated. From day to day, she makes a more humiliating spectacle of herself in the eyes of the world. Weak, vacillating, without purpose or policy, without even the last vestige of pride, she continues to apologize and deprecate on the platform of the world. And of course, individual Englishmen feel it abroad. You rarely meet an Englishman far from home, but he's burning with impatience, disgust, and even contempt of home. Home seems a shoddy place, and when you get here, it's even shoddier than it seems from afar. If abroad you meet an Englishman in office, he is speechless, almost cynical with rage. "What can I do?" he says. "What can I do against the orders from home? I get orders that I must give no loophole for offense against America. All I have to do is to guard against giving offense above all to America. I must be on my knees all the time in front of America, begging her not to take offense when she hasn't the faintest intention even of taking offense." This is from a man who has lived out in the world and who knows that the moment you go down on your knees to a man, he spits on you, and quite right too. Men have no business on their knees. I have an Englishman who wants to go into the United States. Washington has given him a visa and said, "Yes, you can enter whenever you like." Comes a cable from London, "Prevent this man from crossing into the United States." Washington might not like it. What can one do? The same story everywhere. A man is building a railway with nigger labor. Some insolent Jamaica nigger, British subject, larger than life, brings a charge against his boss. Solemn trial by the British, influence from the government. The Englishman is reprimanded. The nigger smiles and spits in his face. Long live the bottom dog. May he devour us all. And this is the pause button. I'm your host, Borzoi, and joining me this week is Nick. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing well, Borzoi.
That reading, I'm sure people are going to ask where that's from. That was from Reflection on the Death of a Porcupine by D.H. Lawrence. But before we get into it, do you have anything you want to plug, Nick?
No, not really. I just really like movies, and I like your podcast. And when I saw the ending, the crescendo of this film, I knew I had to, at the very least, get this one on the pause button to see your see what you thought about it.
Yeah, I'll preface this by saying that Nick was the one who donated for this episode. I do, when I don't know the person in this case, because I've never talked to Nick before, I'm sure I'm going to get requests for this in the future. I will allow this but I will vet you a little bit. I'll talk to you a bit, find out what your audio situation is and how comfortable you are speaking, because I'm not going to just let anybody on. But Nick passed the test, so that's why he's on for this one. He donated for the movie, the Guy Ritchie film, The Gentleman, which I think came out last year. But I think a lot, I can't remember. I know people start talking about it this year, but I think it came out last year, actually. All right, give me your thoughts on this, because I told you before the show I had fun watching the movie, and I have some notes on this, some thoughts, but I'm kind of curious why you wanted to talk about this, especially now that you're mentioning that the ending is really why you wanted to get this on the pause button.
Well, I was kind of coming off of this watching, being very disappointed by the film. Rian Johnson's Knives Out. Because I was expecting just like a relatively entertaining movie, but I found it to be very disappointing because it was a very kind of blatantly anti-white subtext in it. So
yeah, I haven't seen that one, but as I recall, there's a character that's like quote unquote like the teenager's like a quote unquote alt-right character, which they say this stuff, which it comes with a lot of baggage and a lot of ideas of what that exactly means. But from what I understand, there's something involving like the Latina housekeeper or something.
Yeah, the Latina housekeeper is literally like too virtuous, because spoilers to anybody, a spoiler warning for this. But basically, she thinks she accidentally killed the family patriarch, this famous mystery author, and by ODing him on morphine. But then it turns out it was actually the character played by Chris Evans, who ended up swapping the medicine for the morphine. And she actually was so good that she was able to just be able to tell the differences between the medicines. And she actually gave him the medicine by like sheer intuition. It was a really kind of, it just left a huge sour taste for what was otherwise like a relatively well put together film.
Skillfully crafted movie, I guess we could say.
Yeah. And so then I see the trailer for The Gentlemen, and I'm like, oh, this looks pretty interesting. And I go to see it, and then at first it kind of opens up with stuff where you see, you know, multicultural London and whatnot. But then you eventually hit the crescendo, and I'm seeing all these kind of little notes that are really just anti-PC. I don't know the exact extent to which what Guy Ritchie's real views are, because kind of looking at his filmography, it appears that he's had some evolving views. And when we get down to the nitty gritty, I think I can point out some little hints he's giving to the audience that's paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you. So just briefly what this movie is about. This is Guy Ritchie, who's been lately in his career mostly doing stuff like the Sherlock Holmes and the King Arthur movie. He actually kind of took this dive into genre films, but with his Guy Ritchie twist on it. Now, I've never been a fan of his work. I remember years and years ago, I saw the two he was most known for, which was Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch. I don't really remember them that well because I saw them when I was a teenager. And I haven't watched any of his recent stuff, and it was only because you did the donation. I remember Sven was actually talking about The Gentleman as well. I think it was him. So I was going into this kind of knowing a little bit of Guy Ritchie's style, but not really sure what he was going to do with this. I found it to be a fun movie altogether. This is something that if I was at somebody's house and they happened to have it on and there was nothing else to do or nothing else going on, I would have had no problem just sitting through watching it. It's a very well put together movie. It's got some very entertaining sections. I know this movie got into, but anyways, the plot of it basically is the Guy Ritchie movies, man. I'm describing the plot. Basically, it's a blackmail plot combined with a comedy of criminal errors, whereas various factions are attempting to get a hold of this giant pot farm that's hidden all across Britain that's controlled by a American gangster played by Matthew McConaughey, named Mickey, who is trying to get out of the business, and they're not making it easy for him. And multiculturalism and hilarity ensues. I guess would be a quick way to describe the plot, because we could be here for a while trying to untangle bits and pieces of it in a linear fashion, because it's a kind of starts as a non-linear movie.
Yeah, it starts in media res, and then you have the meta movie aspect of it that all makes it very kind of complicated. Trying to write down the notes for it were kind of annoying for labeling, because you kept having juxtaposition between the reporter talking with the lieutenant in the film and the actual story that we're caring about.
Yeah, I can't really remember a lot of the characters' names. I just know because Guy Ritchie casts such well-known actors for a lot of these things, I just know them as the actor's name. So when we talk about the reporter, we're talking about Hugh Grant, and his character is pretty much, it's pretty obviously the character is gay. I mean, in a very stereotypical way as well, with the passes he makes towards Charlie Hunnam, who's the lieutenant for Mickey, Matthew McConaughey, and very very status and commodity or luxury oriented character. And that's that, and as well as the race politics within the movie, is why this movie got into a bit of hot water with its quote unquote casual racism.
Yeah, at first, at least, when I saw the film, I immediately went to go searching because I was like, I honestly was kind of shocked that Guy Ritchie was able to get it made. But upon reflection, the fact that he was working with Miramax meant that he was dealing with a very desperate studio post Weinstein. So I think that Guy Ritchie took advantage of that fact to make a much more un-PC film than he normally could have gotten away with.
And I'll just go ahead. Well, I'll just go ahead and state my view on this because I only got about a page of notes for this, and when I kind of judge like what I have to say by the amount of pages of notes I have on it. But the strongest, and I watched this with my fiance, she kind of knows what I'm about, and she didn't get we both came to the same conclusion on this. This felt like almost like a 1970s level of the kind of bigotry you could get across in media, like almost like a All in the Family, but without the Norman Lear perspective of like, I'm trying to make fun of racism, but like this level where you're allowed to say these things and note people's races and have characters who you can either they're heroic or you can at least enjoy watching them that express bigotry. It's in a sense, it almost feels like there was this gap where he was able to take us back a couple decades in the culture for a brief moment to in this movie. But because this is such a flashy and modern movie and it's set in such a modern Britain, there's a weird kind of clash that occurs because it's being, I guess, because this is being allowed. And with how, especially in a British culture, how hypersensitive they are to this kind of stuff, it does kind of like, it was a little bit of a weird experience watching this at times.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that really kind of made me realize that this wasn't just merely a anti-PC movie, in my opinion, but rather one that I think Guy Ritchie actually has some perspectives that if he were to air out would be labeled something like Our Guy. Not saying he's like a full-on, you know, ethno-nat inside, but that particular was the fact at the very end of the film, or towards the very end, you have that attempted rape of Mickey Pearson's wife. And I realized in that moment, I'm like, oh my gosh. I think that he's actually referencing the Rotherham grooming gang scandals because she has a very Cockney sounding accent. And my family said that's a bit of a leap, but
it is, but actually I can fit these pieces together. I don't know if it's exactly, I don't think it's exactly going after the grooming gangs exactly, because like this actually plays into a note that I have on this. It didn't occur to me, like, that's a great point about her being Cockney, because that is actually explicitly like brought up at least once in the movie that she is Cockney. And Dry Eyes is not he's not a Pakistani, he's Chinese. He doesn't fit the profile of what most of these grooming gangs were composed of. But what you can see, because like the sense I got from this is I kept thinking of George Orwell calling Britain in 1984 Airstrip One. This doesn't feel like Britain. And I mean, like, that is a reflection of also where Britain is now. But in this movie, like, yes, there are British style buildings and they're engaging in some British style commodity culture, but there's very little Britishness in this because Mickey Pearson's an American. A lot of these are immigrant groups, but then you have this attempted rape of a very English woman. A Cockney woman, the attempted rape of a very English woman by an Asian. You could see the grooming gang analog, but you could also see this as the way that Britain has been bought, sold, and raped by countries from around the world, and with the rise in China as well, especially because the Chinese film industry is the Chinese market within the film industry is so integral now to the success of a movie. So you can see that as either a statement or at the very least a cheeky comment on that.
Yeah. I also found something very interesting because I rewatched it one time last night with subtitles so I could catch every little detail. it turns out that in the film, she actually refers to herself as a Jew when talking about...
Oh, she does?
Yeah, yeah, in the dinner scene. And I think I know why. I think because not a lot of people know this. Guy Ritchie actually was married to Madonna for a time, and he actually can apparently speak Hebrew. So I think it could be a subtle reference to that. I may be overreading it, but...
Well, when this movie came out, I know that there were some people that were speculating, because like when the thing came out about the references and comments that are being made in this movie about the reference, like you have Berger, who's explicitly and extremely just viscerally Jewish in this movie with mentions of Mossad crabs and the like. I saw people joking that maybe because of Guy Ritchie's marriage to Madonna, who had famously converted to Judaism in order to practice Kabbalah, that relationship made him go insane a little bit, or at least woke him up to some things, and that this is partially a reaction to that marriage he had. We're completely within the speculative territory of Guy Ritchie's personal life here, but I mean, certainly I would not doubt that his level of knowing Hebrew and his marriage to Madonna has made him aware of Jews. I mean, he's obviously aware of them enough that he made Berger so Jewish within this movie.
Yeah, I really just laughed really hard at the final crescendo when Mickey Pearson demands a pound of flesh for the whole affair. I couldn't believe he actually outright did that, because I knew the kvetching was going to happen, and that was pretty funny.
And of course, if people don't know that reference, that's the Merchant of Venice of I can't remember the character's name. It's
Shylock.
Shylock. people are going to kill me. I should know better.
Shylock.
Yeah, it's the big portion of the play. But there's I guess kind of getting into some of my notes that I have on this. There is the first thing that really struck me about this movie is that there's a sense of Jews and Americans working together to colonize the Anglos. And I think this is very strong because this is what I meant about this whole Airstrip One comment about Britain, because the two main characters are an international Jew, basically, who's got Mossad crabs, and an American who came to England in order to sell weed to the upper class.
Yeah.
And that to me is like one of those striking comments, if there's any to be made about this movie. That's one of those striking comments.
Yeah, there's an interesting I think it could be argued that he is very conscious about this being really social commentary. And I spotted this also last night. You know, the opening scene where he walks into the bar and we think he ends up getting shot in the head.
Mm-hmm.
His mug and the beer tap that he drinks from actually is called the Land of Lore, English Land of Lore. Or where was it exactly? It was called, Land of Lore. And I think that's an explicit kind of little detail that he's using to signal that he's not just telling a story, but rather one that is grounded within the actual place that he is talking about.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I've noticed that a lot of British artists, directors, or whatever medium they're working in exactly. This has been something that's been at the heart of British culture for the 20th century, the sense of the loss of England and the loss of Britain. I mean, even before it was truly lost, they had a strong sense of their decline and what that decline meant, even very early on. That D.H. Lawrence quote that I opened up with is from his unpublished works, during his lifetime, Reflections on the Death of a Porcupine, which were a lot of his scattered writings on unfinished thoughts on various things. I don't remember the exact year that was written in, but D.H. Lawrence died in 1930, so it was more than likely written in the late 1920s. And even then, there was, despite the fact that like the British Empire was still roaring, and you know it would still be able to hold out against Germany with the help of the Allies and all that, but that Britain would still come out winning within the next world war, there was this deep sense of decline that was already within some British writers at that time. And this continues on even after the, especially after the war, that accelerates more than anything. I always remember the Kinks song, Living on a Thin Line, where one of the verses, well, the whole song's basically about like this entire loss of the country and that there's nothing that they have to give down, the hand down to their children anymore. And that was a song I think was written in the 19th. That was probably written during the Winter of Discontent within England. But then, of course, you also have, what was the other example I had? Anyways, I don't want to ramble on. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Yeah, I do think, going back a bit on your referencing one of your earlier comments, I do think that, and to a certain degree, I would say rightly, I think he makes a very important distinction between types of international persons. In particular, I believe he calls attention to the fact that he's not just any generic kind of white American. He's very explicitly from like one of the early Americaner, you know, stocks from, you know, somewhere in the South or maybe Appalachia.
It's pretty clear to me. I think it's I distinctly remembered him being Appalachian. Now that could have just been my reading on it, but I just feel very strongly he was meant to be Appalachian. It was especially kind of like the more Irish kind of background, like a Scots Irish background, and within America, those were always like kind of considered the white trash, but also the rough and tumble fighting sort, which the English. One reason for the colonies was to export a lot of very troublesome elements. Now, there was a lot of money to be made in the colonies, but a big thing has always been get rid of the criminals, get rid of the rabble, just send them somewhere else because they're causing too many problems within the United Kingdom. And well, now it's chickens coming back home to roost.
And I believe you're right, because he does open with the with that folk song about the Cumberland Gap.
Great song, by the way. Yeah, it's Cumberland Gap by David Rawlins. That song's been in, since I watched this movie, that song has been in my head the entire time. And that is an Appalachian reference, because like in one of the lyrics in the song is like Kentucky's on the other side.
Yeah. What I found very interesting, and it was one of the first themes that kind of popped out at me was there was a very strong and marked contrast between the countryside and the city. In particular, with noting about the decline of the natural aristocracy and contrasting it with mm-hmm. the rise of the bourgeois, and I would argue Jew presenting editor Big Dave.
I don't think that's right. I don't think they explicitly say he's Jewish for Big Dave, but it's pretty obvious he's meant to be a Jew.
He even, and here's a little detail I caught on my, I think, a third viewing. He actually has, I believe, a Mockney accent, because he speaks with this kind of like this Cockney style accent, which turns out actually is probably his real accent. I looked at the actor's background. But then after the pig scene, when he wakes up in the van, he actually like speaks with a relatively posh, proper English accent. And it's kind of one of those cultural phenomena in Britain of the declining middle class and upper middle class and whatnot that they try to affect like they're really lower class. I found that to be an interesting little detail.
Mm-hmm. I think I could be mistaken. I'm sure somebody who's English is going to correct me on this, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of that Mockney accent stuff is also a reflection of the amount of people that kind of have that are periphery to the what's called estuary English, which is referring to kind of like living along the River Thames. But because you always, there's this, it's something actually even the English have commented on within, like, it was like bands like Pulp have kind of talked about this, where like there is this slumming tourism that people that have some level of adjacency to the working class and to the chav culture, that because there's this sense of anytime that the poor and that like the put upon are involved in culture, there's the sense that there's this projection from upper classes that there's something more authentic about their culture, because there's a number of different factors in play. Like, you have like, sometimes people just feel guilt, sometimes there's a fascination, sometimes it's just patronizing. But I wouldn't be surprised if some of the Mockney stuff comes from people that have like some level of adjacency to it, and they've kind of fetishized that lifestyle without having lived that lifestyle.
I find it very interesting, as I trace kind of Guy Ritchie's attitudes and portrayals of kind of like the lower classes throughout his career, because in Snatch and Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, it's from the perspective of, and to a certain degree, glorification of the lower classes. Particularly in Snatch, you see a lot of that with Brad Pitt playing a traveler or a gypsy. With this one, it's almost like he's kind of turned face on the lower classes. In particular, I find an interesting contrast between Mickey Pearson's gang and the Toddlers, the kind of gang that's run by Colin Farrell, Farrell's character, and that he shows that one of the key things is like he cannot maintain any order despite being kind of like a very good-natured sort of liberal type of character trying to assimilate all these new immigrants.
Mickey can't assimilate.
Colin Farrell,
the coach. Yeah, it's he's actually that is a good point. Like he's constantly put upon, even though he's harsh on his boys, who is he harsher on? It's the chavs, the ones who now of course the chavs pick a fight with him, but. He has this very paternal, like he's got this very paternal view he has toward like a father to his men type thing for all these black boxers, especially even though these guys are running around committing crimes and filming that and getting him into trouble. He takes a much more paternalistic view towards them, these toddlers, and they're called the Toddlers. They call themselves Toddlers. You can see like there's this babying aspect of these immigrants compared to these chavs. Now, yeah, the chav kids are, they're not good people. They're not good people in the least bit, but it's an interesting kind of contrast you can see. It's almost like that boomer attitude of like, well, these guys are working for it and they came here with nothing and they're the children of immigrants and they're trying to, make something of themselves. And like, look at these white trash and what they're all about.
Yeah. In particular, it's very interesting the framing that Colin Farrell's character, the coach, does when he comes to Mickey Pearson. He basically kind of frames it almost like, oh, well, they just happened, something like a like egging a car or something like that. It was just some sort of impulse decision. It wasn't like this highly premeditated raid on a secured facility,
Yeah, well, because we're both Americans, I take it. Because I don't know much about you, Nick, but I think this is something because of the way that the British class system has kind of historically been, in Britain's relationship with immigration is slightly different than ours has been. Like one thing I found out years ago, because I'd always talk about the white working class, and I knew and this person wasn't one of us. I knew a British person who turned their nose up when I mentioned this. And what I found was, maybe this is, I don't know if this is the widespread, this is just one person I'm getting this from, but the white working class in Britain is kind of no different from what's called, what I've been calling chavs, which is this like very kind of like this, the almost like a lump and prol type class of white people within Britain, white trash, basically. They, at least this person, saw no difference between that. Whereas in the United States, we tend to use the white working class as a catch-all term for basically any white person who's able to make money. It's kind of like, and it isn't wealthy. It's like, that's kind of how we view it. We don't have the kind of same negative perception towards it, because really white working class is a dog whistle for us because of our history with race and immigration and the way that both parties have exploited white anxiety and working anxiety against the people that were coming into this country. But this is a problem I think that I've noticed with the way, and I think this is why some anti-white politics can be particularly bad within Britain, because they've always had this problem of a white very underclass type people that have also been corrupted even more by the various cultures that the immigrants bring as well. It's like, this is like the degenerated version of whites. And there's this, we do have disdain for white trash within this country, but it seems like it's much stronger, that disdain, in Britain.
Yeah. Yeah. You do see that. I mean, despite what, how bad the United States is, I really couldn't imagine the kind of scale of something like a Rotherham or something like that happening in the United States, partially because, you know, we have the Second Amendment, but also because we just don't have that much contempt, at least across the ruling elites. There's still, you know, you still have your micros and whatnot that try to say, you know, try to push the concept of the manual labor being an honorable thing. Mm-hmm. Well,
that's actually bring up a great point there, because, like, I mean, Britain doesn't have guns, but a Kyle Rittenhouse, if he were being, you know, a Kyle Rittenhouse within Britain being chased down the street and all he's got is a knife on him, and his three attackers are the exact same three attackers that Kyle had. He knifes these guys in self-defense. There are like the patriotic alternative people, like the Mark Collettes of Britain, and many of the and there is a very much there still is that core of kind of like a populist Britain that still exists over there, but I don't think that would be even on the same level of the support that Kyle got among regular people here. I don't think a Kyle Rittenhouse in Britain would have gotten the same level of support. And I could be mistaken. I apologize to my British listeners if I got you guys all wrong. But the perspective I seem to have is that despite the fact that you guys are well aware of the pedo problem and the grooming problem you have, there's less of an appetite for, I mean, like, Kyle was self-defense, but like less of an appetite for vigilante violence, which Americans are, Americans love vigilante violence, and they love corrective rape within prisons. That's two things that Americans love.
Yeah. Yeah. In particular, I found it kind of a very striking illustration of these differences when you had that chase sequence for Raymond Smith, the lieutenant, for the phone after they sent that Russian oligarch kid off the balcony, and he's faced with it. I think it's kind of a mockery of the stereotype of the multicultural inner city gang, because he just goes full kind of intersectional for every kind of male, from like, you know, young teenagers to like full grown men, and like what look supposed to look like a local street gang, but looks nothing like it whatsoever. And how he very strikingly uses an MP5 to basically scare off the guys who just have knives. And the reason why I mention that is because there's kind of this running motive, and this is kind of natural because he is an Englishman. He uses this motive of kind of feudalism analogized to criminality. You know, Mickey Pearson is the king with that opening speech, referencing himself as the lion, the king, you must believe yourself. Mm-hmm. He's referred to as a cowboy Caesar. Raymond Smith is a very middle class name, which would have been like the natural base of the gentry, of the low gentry, that is, like the actual gentryman, from which we get the name the gentleman. The actual name of the film being the gentleman, which comes from the gentry.
And there's actually, you're bringing up a great thing that just made me think of a couple of things, because first you have that gentry aspect, because what is he tries to play the consummate, even on a criminal level, Raymond tries to play the consummate Englishman of like, well, let me pay you for that phone. England has, I forget who wrote it, but England has been referred to as an island of shopkeepers. And I wish I could remember who had written that.
It may have been Marx.
I think you're right. I think you might have been right. I think you're right. That's probably. I'm gonna just look it up right now, because it's gonna bother me if I. Oh no, I think it was Nation of Shopkeepers. Oh, commonly attributed to Napoleon, though there's no it's not known if he actually said it. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, you have, but that, I think the perspective, the perception of that, it rings true. I mean, like, we talk about the Anglo character quite a bit, and I can't think of anything more Anglo than even an Anglo criminal going up to a, to a, like a street kid gang and trying to buy the phone off of him. And then when they don't comply, overwhelming force via the gun. I can't think of anything more British than that. But then you bring up this aspect of where he's playing this gentry role. And this is why I brought up the Airstrip One references a lot, is because after World War II, George Orwell wrote 1984 in 1947 and 1948. And even by that point, and I mean, Burnham was talking about this, Orwell talks about this a little bit in a couple of his writings as well, but there was the sense that was only two, maybe three superpowers in the world. The Cold War lines had been drawn rather quickly. And even in Britain, there was this internal debate that either we're going to fall, either we're going to fall within the Russian sphere, or we're going to fall within the American sphere. And even some saying, like, we might even, like, talking about being annexed by America and becoming part of America. And that's where the Airstrip One thing within 1948 comes from. And so you have, again, like this whole aspect within the movie that it's Jews and Americans fighting over a mongrelized Britain, where the sense of British character doesn't even, of British people don't even exist anymore. The most British person within this movie is probably Raymond, and he plays second fiddle. He plays the capo for an American who has come to Britain to colonize it. Now, his colonization is a much kinder, gentler form than the Jews' colonization, but it's still, like, this is a guy who made his money on getting the aristocracy all doped up.
Yeah, I find the portrayal and interaction of Mickey Pearson and the aristocracy to be very interesting. It was one of the things that made me, things that made me really pay more attention to the film, was the fact that Mickey Pearson behaves in the old Roman sense in a very virtuous manner. Like, he honors his obligations. He shows several times that he's willing to go the extra mile because he has an actual relationship with the aristocracy. In particular, what I found very interesting was when he sent Raymond to go and rescue Laura Pressfield, the daughter of one of the dukes. And also, he makes several references to the idea of this being kind of like almost a reenactment of an old time fairy tale. In particular, in the fact that Laura Pressfield is in the royal line, her father at one point was fourth in the line for the throne. Raymond explicitly says that she is a princess or queen of sorts, and she is essentially being captured by what he calls the Dirty Dragon, that is Harrowind. And it's kind of a commentary, in my opinion, on like the old ways. Are you're not going to be able to go back to kind of a Tolkien-esque good king, little England shire type of situation.
Well, the casting, I think, was also deliberate, because when we were watching this, we thought, like, wow, they made that girl look like a heroin junkie, and there was like an androgynous character to her as well. And then I looked up who played that's Sting's daughter. Who played Laura, and Sting's daughter identifies as gender neutral, gender queer, or whatever, I don't know, whatever term it is. And so he deliberately casted somebody who's got this this is somebody who's supposed to be heir to a title, an heir to land, an heir to Britain itself, and they're within a drug den surrounded by chavs and foreigners. Their appearance has been twisted and destroyed by this culture, by these drugs. And like, it's kind of like the face of Britain and its children itself. This is the type, and shows that they can be lowered to just as the same level as those that had been groomed. But one other thing that occurred to me when you were talking about Mickey's relationship with the aristocracy is that that's actually a very American thing, I've noticed. I don't think the British have the same, like, even the biggest British patriot, I don't think has the same regard for the aristocracy that we do, because even America, people are obsessed with royal weddings and like, and I know that over there they have, like, the royals and the aristocracy are a big part of the tabloid culture over there. But my experience of talking with British people is that the upper class, the aristocracy, the nobility are largely considered to be a bunch of tossers and tarts. And I can't really blame them considering how many of them intermarried with Jews. I mean, like, this is that had been going on for quite a long time. This landed aristocracy, they're supposed to be the blood of Britain itself, are very intermarried with a lot of foreign blood and are very disconnected with a lot of British culture. But we Americans, because we are a kind of an ahistorical people, we have an obsession with castles, and we have an obsession with, we love the Lord of the Rings. We love that stuff. Like, one big thing for Americans when they go over to Europe is to see castles, which were just a state. Like, for some European, I'm sure for many Europeans, like, a castle is just a castle. It's like, yeah, like, it's been there the whole time. Like, not a big deal. But for us, we freak out over it because we don't have castles in America. What's the most well-known castle in America? It's the Disney castle. The Magic Kingdom, that's our most well-known castle. So we freak out, and we want to see that stuff preserved. And I can't remember who said this. I think it might have actually been my fiance who was talking to me about this, is that a common thing that you see in a lot of European countries within tourist areas is that those tourist areas are not maintained by the actual native population. It's maintained by foreigners. I wouldn't be surprised if most of them are Americans, but the tourist areas have largely been dominated and colonized by foreigners who, on one level, I think on most levels, it's just opportunistic, because they know, like, they're catering to the market they're trying to make money off of. But there is this some level that there are people that have this deep appreciation for a culture that we don't have, that we are absent of, and we want to see it preserved over there, even if we don't really understand it. It's our own projection of it.
Yeah, there's. The obsession goes a far ways back. During the Gilded Age, I remember reading in one of my old history books, it was actually a noted phenomenon of wealthy business tycoons marrying off their daughters to European aristocracy because they were cash poor and they were cash flush. And that was a very interesting thing. You have examples of, like, Grace Kelly being one of the most iconic actresses of our time, not because of her illustrious acting career, but because she became the Princess of Monaco. Mm-hmm. We see this in how, and we see this kind of deficiency in good old architecture in America. Actually, one of my very half blue-pilled professors basically rants on this all the time about how there's a very large dearth of good architecture in America.
Yeah, and architecture in America has generally gone through waves and phases of a couple of years. So that's, like, why, like, you go to, like, Detroit and Chicago and you see the architecture there. You can, like, there's some very, very beautiful buildings, but you can see, like, oh, well, these buildings were part of when they were going through a neoclassical phase. And these were in Detroit, one of the most famous Art Deco building that's there is the Whitney Building. The architecture there's almost schizophrenic quality to architecture in America because of the way that the buildings were built in the various time periods they were built in. And in fact, actually, I actually posted this on Twitter. There's one of H.L. Mencken's most famous essays, Libido for the Ugly, is where he talks about the architecture that's within the Pennsylvania coal towns. And it seemed as though, like, they went out of their way to make the ugliest buildings possible. And he hypothesized that there is just something within the American character that has a love for ugliness.
Yeah, I'm largely native to the U.S. Capital region, and it's a land of contrasts. You can see some of the most beautiful old buildings in places like the malls, where it's neoclassical architecture and whatnot, or old colonial villages, and just extremely ugly buildings. Like, I couldn't believe how ugly Obama made the African American History Museum for the Smithsonian. I was like, oh man, I wouldn't design an uglier building. I couldn't, quite honestly. Moving on to the next scene, we get introduced to the wife of Mickey Pearson. And I was, like, cringing at first because it strikes this very kind of feminist tone. But later on, we get back to that garage she runs. And I think it very subtly subverts feminism with that.
How so?
In particular, in the fact that she highlights this as being a safe place for women, but she's attacked by Dry Eyes there and threatened with rape, and she fails to fend them off. I mean, she kills two of the guys, but ultimately fails with a very distinctly feminine gun, the Derringer.
Yeah, it is a Derringer. I don't know if that's a, I don't know if that's a exact subversion of feminism, though.
It's a bit of a lot of the stuff is kind of like symbology and inference.
I get what you're saying, but that's why I also when I was kind of giving my initial thoughts on this, it felt like this movie feels like it took a step into culture 20, 30 years previous. I get a sense of a lot of 1970s era attitudes in a lot of this, because even the 1970s, there was a lot of feminism within that, but it was feminism within limits.
Yeah, there could be. You have a point there.
Yeah, because like we are so you like I mean like this is the worst aspect I think of the culture we've created is the merger of the worst elements of superhero pulp fiction, where now because you had comics showing women superheroes that were given that the abilities are then transmitted onto characters that don't actually have superhuman abilities. So that's why you get like and Joss Whedon's a big part of why this occurred, but like you have the badass pixie who's like this, like a 5'2", 120-pound woman who's throwing a 6-foot, 300-pound man over her shoulder. And it's like, that's not even physically possible to do, but because this looks cool and this is we're operating on that all women have superpowers motif within our culture now, like when they have a realistic view of women again, it's like, okay, yeah, a woman can fire a Derringer, but then as soon as she's out of bullets, the man has the upper hand. Like, and it seems shocking to us because we are so brined now within this Whedon-esque culture.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. I found his aesthetic choices for the characters to be very interesting. In particular, I think the entire time Mickey Pearson is actually dressed in like a proper English suit, and I found that to be kind of an interesting contrast with Matthew Berger, who does not really. He dresses in this kind of like fusion of old business class, but also Silicon Valley-esque, you know, like turtlenecks and whatnot.
That's a very. I think would say that's also like a very Jewish thing. That's the kind of one of the clashes between Berger and Pearson, is that Pearson, even though he is this American who is colonizing Britain through drugs, like he maintains this level of assimilation and appreciation for Britain, which you could, like, if you want to read into what Guy Ritchie's intentions were, you could see that as that Anglo, like that white Americans and British, like we are close enough where when we go back and forth between our countries, we will assimilate to those small changes within them and appreciate each other's culture and become part of that country. But these people these Jewish characters will never do that as such. And I think it's interesting that weed is such a huge aspect of this in trying to sell the weed industry to Berger, because this is a very Jewish scheme that he's basically doing. Not just the way he tries to undercut Mickey, but the way that this is predicated, like, well, one day, like, this is obviously going to be legalized someday, so I'm going to be in on the ground level and make a lot of money when it goes legal, which is how a lot of the prohibition industry was running. Like, everyone knew that prohibition was not going to last, and so towards the waning days of it, they, you know, a lot of these people were in position where they were ready that once it went legal, they would have control of the industry.
I found it interesting how, and probably an effect of the fact that Guy Ritchie still is kind of a man of his milieu, in that he's basically trying to say, well, weed isn't that bad of a drug, or just socially destructive of a drug. In fact, that's like one of the things that Mickey Pearson uses to distinguish himself from Lord George. And that Lord George was basically funneling opiates. I found that to be interesting at the time, that it was kind of a, maybe a subtle nod to the Chinese fentanyl manufacturing base, possibly.
I'm sure like a lot of the comments in China are intentional within this. I also see it as a nod a bit to some of the themes of The Godfather, because in the original Godfather film, you have this idea of the criminal of this immigrant class that comes to another country. And the opening line in that movie is, I believe in it. And if the gentleman is about what is Britain, then the Godfather is about what is America. The opening line is, I believe in America. And this idea is that is for Michael to, like, he's not supposed to join the criminal side of the family. He's supposed to go on to become a senator. He's supposed to, like, it's part of this whole idea of the gentrification of the criminal class, which is it's actually a common and consistent theme with organized crime in liberal society, in liberal society's rather short history, is that they become gentrified to a certain extent. And this is often concurrent with the legalization of different things. But within The Godfather, they're largely involved in the prohibition and other racketeering sides of the business. But the big conflict that puts the Corleone family at odds with other families is that they do not want to get involved in the heroin trade. It's seen as dirtier. It's seen as lower. It's seen as like a nigger thing, is the way that they kind of perceive it. And so there's these themes within these crime movies that there's this balance of what's considered acceptable drugs and how does one gentrify oneself to become a part of respectable society. And that's a theme within this movie, where Mickey is like, he did, you know, he came from the bottom. He made his excuses for what he was doing, but now he's ready to get out of it and join proper British society in retirement.
Yeah. You do see this. One of the other things that piqued my interest, especially this time around, was there are multiple times that he has Mickey Pearson very consciously draw upon the fact that he is a white guy in a way. One is gentrification, which is really kind of, it's basically code for only rich white people to a certain degree. Also, I found it interesting how when he talks to Matthew Berger in his on one of his weed farms, he calls the attention to the fact that he's got blood, and he specifically highlights that there are white hands. That could technically just be trying to provide some vivid contrast, but in the context of this film where everybody's kind of mentioning who's whom, I don't think that is an meaningless color contrast.
Oh, I think you're correct, because he draws attention in a meta way to of film as well. Like that, even though like that was actually one of the weakest parts of the movie, because he kind of dropped that whole aspect. Like there was a meta aspect early on to the movie, and he just kind of didn't really follow through on that. There's a little bit of a payoff at the end, but it's a rather weak theme throughout it. But he draws attention very explicitly to certain things in the site. I don't think that's an accident at all. But the thing you said that actually kind of piqued my interest is the gentrification kind of being a code for being white. And that's another thing within crime movies. And that's, I guess, one of the subtle strengths of this movie, is because when we talk about one of the reasons why our enemies often talk about, well, what it even is white, and because and this fungible definition of white, and that white is a social construct, is that we do have historically and culturally this sense of what it, like, of acting white. And when people are not, remnants of it are still within our speech. You know, it's mighty white of you, and the way that we view white trash. This idea, like the Italians not being white, it's not that they weren't European, but there was this differentiation about them. And oftentimes that could be a religious difference. Oftentimes it really was just a religious difference, but it was this, it was this otherness, and their insistence on maintaining that otherness that made them feel not quite white. And so what is gentrification if not the process of losing that otherness to finally assume that final assimilation? And that theme is within The Godfather, but that same relationship we have with the Italians, we had with the Irish as well. And so there's a little bit of hint of irony in this, because the first the first immigrant group we really had a lot of issues with were the Irish, and it's because of their general tendency to be rough and tumble, to fight, to be Catholic, to be outside of our general culture. And you have now America taking on the refuse of the British Empire, sending it back to Britain. And he, in this sense, he is representing this gentrification. Like, we've come home. We are now one of you. I had to do it through rough and tumble means. I had to do it through illegal means, but now I am one of you. I am white.
Wow. Shoot, I just had a brain fart. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
What did you think of Raymond's speech in the apartment block about, you know, basically kind of saying, why couldn't you just, like, be a little bit degenerate? Why do you have to go to heroin, basically?
Is this when he's lecturing the kids in the apartment? Is that, I'm trying to remember the scene. What scene are you referring to?
Yeah, I was in the apartment where he... He also name drops White Guilt, another...
Oh, okay, yeah, this is when he's lecturing the kids and Laura's there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's... Guy Ritchie's movie, I think, is primarily for a white audience, and that's who he made it for. And it might be a reason why some of the people who had issues with it had issues with it. I don't know. And again, like, this is not a whole defense of, like, oh, Guy Ritchie's, like, secretly a Nazi and secretly our guy, and he's coding this with different messages. I think there's, I mean, like, the making fun of liberal white guilt is a common trope. One thing I've noticed in the last 5 to 10 years, 5 years especially, is these guys that had a reputation for being transgressive, for breaking all conservative morals and mores, guys like Guy Ritchie, guys like the writer of American Psycho, what's his name?
Bret Easton Ellis.
Bret Easton Ellis. Like, these guys who, like, after they came, like, this is a common thing. You go all the way through transgression, and you come out the other side despising liberalism. They come to this kind of equilibrium where, like, well, what, like, let's just, like there shouldn't be any need for guilt. There shouldn't be any need, like, let's be open and on. Like, it gets the kind of, like, almost a casual racist part where portion of, like, your career, it's like, well, you should be able to say whatever you want about anybody. Like we shouldn't be, like, hurt, like, who cares about hurt feelings? Who cares? Like don't have this liberal white guilt about this. Like, and they might even, like, say anti-white stuff from time to time, but there's this sense, like, well, other people should be able to take it as well. Like, if you can dish it out, you should be able to take it. And I don't know, that's the sense I get from that scene of Guy Ritchie. Like, he's speaking to his white audience.
Yeah, there's a certain degree of that, and I did notice that thing you've been harping on about this basically just being racist but from the 70s in its time period, because you have, he basically says, why couldn't you have just smoked some weed and drank some booze and had casual premarital sex? And you see him also return to that later on with the scene with the coach, which admittedly was pretty funny, where one of the toddlers gets all uppity about being called a black cunt. I found that pretty funny.
Yeah. There's definitely some humorous scenes in that, and that's, I think that goes to what I'm saying, like, that, like, if you can dish out, you should be able to take it, and that, like, it's, you know, or, like, the, like, I'm not bigoted, I hate everybody equally, or, like, basically, like, I can't be racist as I make fun of everybody. I get that strong vibe from this. What I would say about this movie is that it's not a systemic critique, but it has systemic comments. And that's, like, where that's, to me, is, like, the most interesting stuff. There's a lot of systemic comments I see about the state of Britain and what it means to be British in a society like this. But a lot of the casual racism of it, it's not a, even though he, I did a whole post about this, like, knowing about Jews doesn't make you one of us. Like, a lot of powerful people know about Jews, but they might have their own novelty takes what it means to know about Jews, and there are plenty of people that are willing to work with Jews or even make fun of Jews but still work with them, and not see, like, how the system is used in a particular way and in a particularly anti-white way. It's what the most striking thing about this movie to me is that he's not making any strong comments about anti-whiteness in particular, but he is making comments about the contradictions and the tension of living in a multicultural society.
I really wouldn't say or try to argue that, you know, he's our guy, but I think he is kind of noticing these things, and he's in his own little way kind of shooting back at it. Now, what perspective is he exactly shooting back from? I think it could be kind of argued based on how sympathetically he portrays kind of the old English aristocracy. And I think this is because he actually comes from the British upper class. But he was also simultaneously immersed in the British lower class as well. That he really has a certain reactionary tendency or instinct to him.
Well, I definitely think with the way that this movie, like who are the main villains? Jews and Chinese. And the Jews and Chinese actually even work together at some point. And with that Chinese connection, this movie is in some respects about middlemen minorities. He doesn't, these are very implicit themes within the movie, but you can see that there is a, when you look at all the different groups that are represented within this movie, even when you have a case of the coach and he's got his black boxers and all of that, there is a sense that they belong to something. They belong to a culture of some kind, even if it's not a culture I would ever approve of. I find it rather disgusting, but there is at least some tangential sense of belonging. But with the Chinese and the Jews in this movie, there's an outsideness about them that permeates constantly in this movie. They come across very strongly as people who are just there. They're there to make money, and they're there to facilitate drugs. That's all they're there for.
Yeah, Lord George very specifically says, you know, I facilitate, I do not participate.
Exactly. Yes. That's the very, and Berger would say the same thing. And both Chinese and Jews. I mean, this is something that people who have tried to, like, on a highbrow level study anti-Semitism have talked about, the problem of the middleman minority, and that for mysterious reasons, the Jews are just like the ones that are targeted the most. But this is the problem that middleman minority have often encounters. Like, well, they are fundamentally facilitators, but they are also people because, and some of that middleman minority aspect comes from the sense that they have a much stronger an internal ethnic centrism, that, and they have a much more internal sense of cohesion, so that when they go to other places, they don't truly lose that aspect. Now, Chinese actually do have a history of assimilating much better than Jews do, which is a big reason why Jews get more hate than Chinese do. But like, these are currents that are within all middlemen minorities.
Yeah, I found the contrast of how Lord George acted, in the fact that he has a name that suggests assimilation. I don't know if he's an actual like lord, or if that's just a title that he goes about by. But you know, he basically kind of appears to be that kind of ideal British bulldog nationalism. Like, oh, he's one of the British Hong Kongers that, you know, should come back to be freed from China. Yet at the same time, he is selling, as McPherson termed, the destroyer of worlds. You know, he's damaging the very country that he wraps the flag around himself.
Well, and you can see a replacement motif in that as well, which is why, like, I connect. That's why when we talked about the attempted rape on Mickey Pearson's wife, I saw more of a comment on the Chinese than I saw a comment on the grooming gangs. Not that like that both can't be true, but because the Chinese occupy such a huge aspect of this movie with their trade, and you have this character of Lord George, who he facilitates, as you say, the destruction of people like Laura, who's a British heir. And how does he act? He tries to supplant who the ruling aristocracy is in name. He's now known as Lord George. He is the Lord, and he has the power to take your daughter, get her hooked on smack, and destroy her life, and eventually kill her. Like, this is he has the capability of destroying your offspring, your future, and because him and he and his people are the future, and they're going to just take your titles as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that interpretation makes more sense of the scene, though I still would find it funny that it is kind of a mockery of the euphemism of Asian grooming gangs that's very uncommonly used in British media. So
yeah, I guess I just don't know, because like I think they call them, or I don't know if the term is fallen out of use now. That for East Asians, the term they used was Oriental. I think most people know by now, like if you say Asian in a British context, they usually mean South Asian, because they historically had a much larger population of Indians and Pakistanis. Could also be a pun, who knows? I mean, like I am not familiar enough to know if like that connotation would come across to a British viewer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
there's one big note I had. We kind of moved past it, but like on that liberal white guilt thing, I did actually have a note as well about the kids that are within that scene. I mean, the kids in the drug dens are also Antifa types. These are children of the elite or well-to-do who got into drugs or have some complex about the lifestyles their parents lead. And this is like, we kind of buried that a little bit because we talked about Laura, but like all of those kids go to prep schools. I don't know. I misspoke. I had forgotten about that. I called them Chav types. And though, like those are prep school kids that got hooked onto drugs.
But that actually makes it, that reinforces your point actually, because mm-hmm. they were Chav presenting, quote unquote.
Yep.
That's exactly what Antifa largely is. There are a lot of trust fund kids and Jews that are, you know, LARPing as, oh, I'm representing the working class, the working people.
Yeah. Well, they just descend into being lumpen proles is what they are. I mean, it's not for nothing that Antifa are full of prostitutes and drug addicts. I bring up the Marx quote, or like the Marxist view on this constantly, of what like the lumpen prole are, is that they are actually poison to revolutionary movements because, well, they poison it with their destructive tendencies. Like these are not people who actually have revolutionary potential. They always sell out to reactionary forces. Because they're not a smart group of people. These aren't people who read. These aren't people who have the perception. Some of them have their minds destroyed by drugs. They don't have the ability to see that they are operating on reactionary tendencies. So they don't see how that they're actually, despite calling themselves anarcho-communists, they don't see that they're actually used by the liberal bourgeois powers to break up anybody that's got a problem with liberal bourgeois powers.
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely, that's basically, if I'm understanding you correctly, that basically you're saying they unironically Antifa are the real fascists.
Antifa are the real reactionaries. The last, like, I think the biggest, like, kind of like last kind of note I had on this, not to say like I'm wrapping up the episode here, but just going through my notes, a problem people I think have with messaging in media is that they treat all messaging as equal when it's not. So people have wondered if Guy Ritchie got red pilled or something, and that doesn't really matter. The key thing in this movie is that bad people, criminals notice race and ethnicity, and good people never notice that. And one enticement of media is that you get to live the vicarious thrill of the villain. Video games like Grand Theft Auto are the same way. It's play criminality, but it's always within the realm of a criminal or a bad person doing this, and it's coded that way. There's no depiction of a good, honest, upright, and moral person who notices race and ethnicity.
Yeah, I actually kind of noticed something like this going outside of the film, in the kind of broader context of like the 2019 film season. Did you follow that Twitter guy that was doing the Joker N-word countdown?
Oh yeah, I remember that. It was, yeah, it wasn't like some kind of Jew or something.
Yeah, some kind of Jew that basically didn't actually do the bit with follow through and made a joke about Batman being the black man. But I believe it was Dick Masterson that made the point that it was very interesting. It was a case of like media, of a media archetype kind of coming to life to allow us to all pretend to be edgy and explore, and saying like this basically religiously proscribed, taboo word. And I found that to be very interesting. 2019 in general was a very interesting year of film. A lot of films that were exploring basically kind of white characters in various states of society.
Yeah, it makes me wonder why Parasite ended up winning Best Picture. I actually saw Parasite recently. It's a decent film. It's got some interesting things to say, especially, but that's largely within the Korean context. And there's things that are, you can see it as like a general capitalist critique, but just because like I have familiarity with the Korean culture, I saw very explicit Korean critiques within that movie. So I found it very interesting that it ended up winning Best Picture. I don't know if that's because a lot of movies got their votes split, if they didn't know how to deal with the Joker movie, or if it's a case of where they had to put a kibosh on a lot of these, like put pump the brakes a little bit on some of the racial and ethnic discussions that were ramping up in that, in some of the films in that time period.
Yeah, I even saw it got so bad at some points that I even in kind of like my normie conservative circles, the more blue-pilled ones were basically decrying all these films like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as basically being like, oh, it's just a cry for conservatism of back in the 1950s when everyone was white and things like that. And I was actually surprised to see that, to be honest, because even blue-pilled kind of conservatives, at least amongst my cadre, try to avoid about being about race.
Well, what I find interesting about that is, are you familiar with like women with these dumpster fire women who they're often very Antifa types themselves, but they dress in 1950s style fashion as though like they're reclaiming it in some way?
I think I may have seen a couple, but I'm not intimately familiar.
Maybe it's just because, I don't know, maybe it's if it's bigger in the Midwest, or maybe it's just because I'm used to living in college towns or being around this type of kind of millennial hipster culture or whatnot. But I've noticed that even among, it's the same reason why you have extremely feminist women that have really messed up BDSM fetishes that involve either they involve rape or they involve power disparities or weird incestual stuff, where there's this media fetishized idea of what the previous decades offered in terms of control and normalcy. And because things are so out of control and it does not appear that there's anybody at the wheel, people start to turn like the past into a type of commodity, almost like the Disney World, Disneyland aspect of like, well, I'm going to, instead of going to travel around Europe and actually understand what it means to be European, experience European culture, I'm going to go through the Epcot World Pavilion, wear lederhosen and drink a lot of beer, and then, you know, sexually harass the waitresses or what have you as I experience what it means to do a world tour. It's an easier, hyper real, much more commodified form of that. And I think we're starting to see that with our own past as well. This like the sense of like, well, if you go back to the 1970s and 1950s, there's a sense of style, there's a sense of control, there is a sense of like of cohesiveness and culture there. Now it's got all this icky stuff, and how do we deal with that? But people want to go back to that, but they don't really want to go back to that. They want an Epcot form of the past.
Yeah, I've actually seen a weird version of this kind of thing formalized into an argument on the right. Are you familiar with William Lind?
Yeah, he's the fourth generation warfare guy, isn't he?
Yeah, but he also has this book. Little caveat, I haven't read the book, but I read one of his books that talks about this idea a lot. It was like a novel, and I would not recommend the novel. And it's basically the idea of retro culture, and the idea is, well, you know, the car atomized people, therefore we should ban cars in order to maintain everything. A type of weird neo-Ludditism that was...
Yeah, it's like almost like No, it's not, yeah, it's not even, I was gonna say, like, it was like a form of archaeofuturism, but not even that, because archaeofuturism is about like merging the past and technology together. But yeah, no, like this, that's actually also, funnily enough, that's like Lind is actually doing the bit of people who misrepresent what the Graf Twitter position on technology is, of like, where like, oh, you have critiques of technology, you must be like an Anprim, you better destroy your glasses because that's technology. It's like, that's not what the argument is. But you do have it's kind of the rubber band effect as well, like where people, like when they become aware of some of the harsher truths about race and ethnicity, they go into like the opposite directions, like, okay, so now I know that Blacks and Jews and Mexicans are actually like different people, I guess we have to gas them now. Like, nobody said that. Like, why did your mind immediately go to that? Oh, so it's because that's how your brain was trained to think. Well, the same thing happens with technology. It's like, oh, technology might have some bad aspects and have some destructive qualities on humanity, I guess we have to ban all technology now. It's like, nobody was arguing that. Like, we're trying to have a clearer picture of what all these different things are, and you have to have a nuanced view on that, but people aren't trained to have a nuanced view. So they go for these extreme things. And part of that is to your point, is about, it's this fetishization of the past, or of like a sense of normalcy. I try not to be too harsh on this aspect anymore, but I used to make fun of people who wanted to go like, that I perceived of wanting to go back to the 1950s, and their conception of the 1950s was advertisements that they saw of the idealistic view of the 1950s. Like, yeah, let's go back to the time period when they were advertising horrible drugs to pregnant mothers and giving them thalidomide in the 1950s. Let's go back to that time period. But I understand, like, it's just the sense of wanting to belong somewhere that's not insane.
Yeah, there really is a type of holistic impulse, and I think that's one of the reasons why, for example, that Fallout, in a way, was the series is so popular, because even though, you know, it's literally a nuclear apocalypse, it's somehow less crazy than our present society.
Yeah, it's especially in the early games, Bethesda games, it was this idea that basically both morality, sensibilities, and moralities and sensibilities had crystallized in the 1950s and went on that way for another 100 years. So those attitudes never changed. And the commentary is also on, like, this is what leads to the entire nuclear apocalypse of the entire world now. But because you get to live in the outcome of that, and role play like this clash of sensibilities with this ruined world, it creates this interesting aesthetic that people just like, but the point is largely lost because it's a little bit too complex and too fantastical of a point to make. It's too divorced from the reality of the situation. So what people see is like, oh, I like this aesthetic, and even though I'm in a ruined hellscape, I wouldn't mind living with this aesthetic.
Yeah. And you see echoes of that idea in the film, in that in the opening shot, the opening song, Cumberland Gap, is actually dialogical music, or diegetic music, from an old fashioned jukebox. That struck me as very hipsterish, which runs to that, and also the fact that this is all framed as being a shot on, you know, actual film as opposed to digital video. I wasn't able to find any technical specifications to find out what camera it was shot on for the original thing, but it is something within the filmmaker community, a question of what do we shoot on, because there's a kind of real instinctual artist reaction against the complete digitization of everything. Christopher Nolan being one of them, and Tarantino both being very famous proponents of actual film.
And this is where you get into the danger and why you have to have a holistic view of the stuff, because when you don't have a systemic understanding of those things, you're not making systemic critiques on it. What you fall into is you fall into the problem of affectation. Because I have for example, We have a record player, and we have what my friend Plaza calls Reddit discs. We have a bunch of vinyl. But we have this combined with a number of other music mediums. But I can't really quite put my finger on why I like to listen to the vinyl. But I know it's in watching the needle rise. It's in watching it move. It's in the hearing a little bit of the crackling. I'm not an audiophile, so I would never be able to make an audio argument for vinyl whatsoever. But I understand. Like, I am fully complicit in this problem of affectation, because what I'm trying to do is I'm chasing a feeling, a sense of something that was lost, and trying to merge that. And that's one thing that I think people within our thing kind of have to do, is like, we're never going to be able to recapture the past, but we have to find a way to merge it into the future. But one thing that I see, like, this is the more hipster elements, and I think, I don't know if Guy Ritchie's commenting on this or if he's indulging in it, but there's a tendency to fetishize that past and try to go back to it on a material level without having without being able to merge it into the future. And Frank just wrote in the chat, modern vinyl is Finkelpink.
yeah.
I can't argue against that. He's not wrong. I bought it to the audio Finkelpink.
And you, to a certain degree, you see that in you see that manifest almost visually in all these movies that came out recently, and that they have that strong period piece aesthetic to them, that you get to, for a brief time, live in the past. It's not just that they are either contemporaneous or past references. All of them have this very strong, visual element that harkens to a very specific time and place. None of them really are timeless, at least amongst the Western films. Having a bunch of old-time style suits and whatnot, very distinctly British. The Joker being set in the 80s and 70s in New York, and so on.
And part of this goes to the capitalist realism thing that Mark Fisher wrote about, because he said in that book, it is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. But a corollary to that I would see is that nobody can imagine a future anymore. The fact that most people's ideas of the future inevitably go towards dystopia, there's no optimistic futurist sense of what's to come anymore, especially from technology or from even like this. As we move more towards this social justice culture, people actually become less pessimistic about the future. You don't, like, these social justice people, for instance, have no optimistic vision of the future. That to me is the most striking thing about their ideology, the ones that actually are like true believers and have a more developed sense of it other than just upcomings. Because if you go back to how a lot of white people were sold on being anti-racist and towards a much more fair and just society, you look at the speeches of Martin Luther King as written by Stanley Levinson. These were optimistic, or like, even take Star Trek, but these were optimistic visions of a future where people are nice to each other and where we live in harmony. There's no sense of optimism anymore. Nobody has an optimistic view of the future. All people think of is how severe the restitution is going to be. Like, that's like, as long as I don't get destroyed too badly, that's like people's optimistic vision of the future. And I think that feeds a lot of this look to the past, because there's nothing to look forward to.
Yeah. And you can see that quite concretely in the lack of invention of new aesthetics. I believe it was you that actually said it in one of your earlier episodes, that like the Matrix was the last movie to really spawn a new aesthetic of some sorts that was identifiable. All these movies are essentially recycling some previous aesthetic in some way.
Yeah, because like, if you look at the odds in terms of what the culture has been, used to be like you can measure culture by the decades. And that's a bit of a simplistic thing, but it's a good, it was a generally a good heuristic, at least for the 20th century. That, like, there's a 10s fashion, there's a 20s fashion, there's a 30s fashion, there's a 40s fashion, there's a 50s fashion, a 60s fashion, a 70s fashion, 80s fashion, 90s fashion. When I go through all those decades, you will think of something from, well, not maybe not all of them, because people don't have, don't aren't going to be aware of all of them, but like the 20s, the 50s, the 60s, 70s, and the 80s, and the 90s, people are going to have an idea. If I say that, it conjures an image in your mind. That's the aughts is actually a little bit more difficult, and that's where you start to see things break down. And that's, in my view, because you had, this is where culture started to become very static. It had this level of merging and melding that was kind of incomplete, and there was some uncertainty about that. And then when you get into this past decade we just got out of, because the internet had become so ubiquitous and people had access to all the digitized information of our culture and other cultures, that people could pick and choose and create their own atomized, individualized culture. It's hard to think of an aesthetic from the aughts and from the teens, other than a couple of well-known marks or well-known events or certain aesthetic tastes that came from it. Like, for example, the music that stands out to me the most is probably like the synthwave or vaporwave thing. And dubstep and mumble rap. That's to me like that. That is what I can think of that was specifically from that time period. And then from the aughts, a lot of different boy bands and hip hop. But it doesn't have the strong cultural markers anymore. And I think as we go into this decade, those cultural markers are just going to become even fewer and fewer, especially because there's no sense of belonging anymore.
Yeah, as I was reflecting upon it, I made very similar observations, in particular, how the last distinctive cultural markers are all music styles. That's another very interesting thing I found about this movie, as well as the other movies. Almost all of them are using, make use of more timeless, old sounding instruments. The Joker film famously uses the bass very extensively. In here, we see a mixture of classical music, if I recall correctly, and neo-folk with the case of David Rawlings. It's actually a reference to, you know, an earlier folk song.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Yeah, I mean, like that's another thing about our culture. It tends to become we move towards recursiveness now. We're just constantly, it's not just looking to the past, but it's constantly making reference to the past. And if you create something new, it's only reference to the past. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong, obviously, with referencing the past. You have to have a sense of past and future. But when you have no sense of future and all you have is the past in an increasingly more commodified form of the past, you run into a lot of problems with that. I'm out of notes. I don't know if I want to make sure you get through everything that you wanted to talk about with this. Was there anything we missed on this?
Not particularly to the movie. I mean, if you want to keep on this conversation about, you know, the constellation of movies that came out in 2019, we can do that. But
I didn't. Well, the problem is I'm not going to have much to say. Is that I didn't watch a lot of movies from that. In fact. I'm trying to remember, what movies did I see from 2019? I just saw Parasite recently. I can't think of any other movies that came out. I haven't even seen Joker yet. I can't think of, I just know about the themes of it and the plot of it because it was so well memed on, but I can't think of anything particular. I can speak to trends, but I can't speak to specific movies.
Yeah. I didn't expect that we would be able to continue the conversation.
I think this was a very productive conversation. So would you recommend The Gentlemen?
I would. Warning. You know, obviously there's that rape scene. So if it arouses you. Oh, one last little note on that I forgot to mention. I'm sorry. What I mentioned.
That was a poorly worded statement, my friend.
Oh, gosh.
But go on. Anyways, moving on.
I found it very interesting how rape scenes are like the last basic thing that will invoke anger and shock in audiences these days. Mass death will not shock people typically, but sexual violence, particularly against women and children, does in fact do that.
Well, they're already working on eroding that with transgression, I think, through the avenues of transgression. But that one's going to be a little bit of a, I think, of a harder nut to crack, just because it's so instinctual to us. I mean, like, one needs to look at the reaction of the reaction towards Kyle Rittenhouse, the outpouring of support he got, and the people like who were ecstatic that he in self defense killed a child toucher. And I think the other aspect to this movie as well, and like in this, because what people need is they need the public. This is why public executions were a big thing. It was for two reasons, really. If you can look at the Foucault argument, which was that it was a way of the sovereign establishing his power and dominance over a population by publicly executing people. It showed where power was and what power had the ability to do. But you can also look at that as because culturally we do need a catharsis in terms of bloodlust. I think, I mean, this is not a novel concept. Aristotle, when he's talking about the purpose of tragedy, he saw that as a cathartic response for the population to be able to see a tragedy occur on stage and have this purging of emotions. I think there's this purging of bloodlust that probably needs to happen, and that was one popular reason for the public execution. Frank is pointing out in the chat here that the climax to him was that Mickey saying that he wanted a pound of flesh for touching his wife, for facilitating the situation where his wife was nearly raped. And that's the kind of thing that normal men respond to very greatly. I would say, you know, another scene that comes to mind, and this was a scene my father loved, when I remember my father having a deep love of this scene, is in the movie Gladiator, that scene where Commodus is trying to get what's his name, Maximus, to reveal his name, and then he does that whole speech and spiel about being, you know, husband to a murdered wife, father of a murdered son, and that he's going to have his revenge in this life or the next. I mean, that's another scene that I think that speaks to men on a certain level. Same thing with the way the movie 300 operated.
Yeah, it's something that I really find, sadly, a division in our culture is talking about how, and I partially blame American Protestantism on this, because we like to talk in cliches. We'll often talk about, you know, we'll quote Jesus saying, no greater love of a man than this, than he lays down his life for his friend. And we consequently have lots of these very powerful scenes evoking that concept of sacrifice. But at the same time, it's a kind of flip corollary. And this is demonized by things like, by feminist tropes, like the woman in the refrigerator, is that men often express our depths of love by our willingness to, in a certain sense, dehumanize ourselves to render violence on behalf of those that we love.
And that trope you're referring to, for people who aren't aware of it, the woman in the refrigerator trope, is that when a woman character, a loved one, typically usually the wife of a male protagonist, gets murdered, so that, and her death is basically a plot gimmick or a plot point just to get the main character on a roaring rampage of revenge. And it doesn't really, like, who she was in her life doesn't actually fundamentally matter in the grand scheme of things. What matters is the male protagonist's rage and his ability to extract revenge for what was taken from him. But that's a general problem of media in general. And I think there are some salient critiques of that kind of trope. I think it just has to be done in the context of what it means to be a family man, because that's something you actually see very poorly within media, is the idea of being a family man, which actually, to this movie's credit, you do sense a genuine love that Mickey has for his wife, and there's a genuine relationship within this movie. It doesn't feel like she's a prop for him.
Yeah, to a certain degree, you see a kind of more, I would argue, a little bit more of a realistic depiction of how it would end up in reality in the case of Taken, in that you have Liam Neeson kind of trying to be a dad, but he's not terribly good at it. take out that, put out that comment, last comment, because I remember noting that, because I was quite frankly shocked to see it, despite being, Justice versus Revenge. It was a real thing. I wish there was a good movie that could talk about the difference, could go into the nuances of it from a masculine perspective, but oftentimes you don't really see that.
I'm sure that movie exists, but it's probably in a much older movie.
Yeah. So I guess to kind of wrap this up, I would recommend it. However, it is very gratuitous in language. I think there's like 150 F words in it. So.
Oh, I think my audience, especially me, is like immune to that at this point.
I know, but I'm just trying to like give a little warning, you know, in case somebody pops it on and they're like, oh, well, I didn't want to pop that in front of the kids with that much.
Yeah, well, definitely don't watch this movie with your kids. But as for me, I found it, I enjoyed it. If you just, it's, I don't know if I would recommend it, but if you're just looking for a decent crime caper that's recent, that's not going to piss you off too much, it works for that. It's a fun movie. There is actually, I had a friend who watched this, and their comment about it was really funny, because they were very dismissive of the movie. They called it Mission Impossible, but named the Jew. Mission, second mission, learn you were set up and betrayed and then avenge. Which, the movie is what it, that's a cliche, it is what it is. The movie, it's nothing, it's not a based in red pill, like, I have to see this movie, but if you're looking for something to watch, I don't, you could do worse. That's my perspective on it. But, I guess I'll just quickly mention, I think the next episode I'm going to do, it's definitely either going to be Starship Troopers or it's going to be an education. Hopefully I'll be able to stick on schedule for that. And then I'll start, you know, I'll be open up for donations again soon for people who want to sponsor an episode. You just keep in mind that if you want me to do it, the best way to get me to do it is give me a reason. Like, sometimes people will suggest stuff and it's like, okay, why? Like, I ran one reason why Maniac had such a long delay, and that is that I had to actually watch it twice to be able to get the notes for it. And if you really want to grease the skids a bit for me, just don't tell me what to think about it, but give me an idea of like why I might find it interesting and make it worth my while and all. And I'll generally do just about anything within reason, of course. But with that, I'm going to push the pause button on this.